Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
February is the home of African American History Month and Groundhog Day. This month's show, Crystal and I turn you on to some Mutated Jazz by Roscoe Mitchell and the unclassifiable pop delights of Santa Gold. Julie and Amanda feature books by Nathan McCall and L.A. Banks. Bill and Clint tell us about two very different but socially conscious films, Diary of the Dead and Killer of Sheep. This is where we talk about music that we like.
I can't believe you listened to that.
I was happy to discover Roscoe Mitchell's Composition Improvisation Numbers 1, 2, and 3 here at the library. Few names are more prominent in the history of improvised music than Mitchell's. Founder of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, one of free jazz's most high-profile groups, Mitchell was commissioned by the city of Munich to compose a piece for a symposium on improvised music being held at Ludwig Maximilian University. Together with Evan Parker, a sax improv legend in his own right, they handpicked 12 other prominent players from around the world for a group they dubbed the Transatlantic Art Ensemble. Besides a full range of saxophones, the group included trumpet, clarinet, flute, a string section, piano, two basses, and two percussionists. As the title implies, the piece is part composed and part improvised. Mitchell has always had a tendency towards European atonalism more so than other free jazz composers. We can hear that dissonance in this sample from section 5. You might have noticed the creeping bass. For every nod to the concert hall, there is one to the club. Sometimes this record actually swings, but it's a fever dance. The rhythm is there, but the melody is in an off-key modality. The unique instrumentation lends itself to such juxtapositions, as does Mitchell's method of controlled improvisation. Sometimes asking players to improv on a limited number of notes, sometimes giving players six cards with scored motifs and asking players to improvise around those motifs, and sometimes scoring whole sections, traditionally, with space for individual solo improvisation. This piece, as with most of Mitchell's music, is all about creating tension. Such tension has no reference point, though, without a little release, as we hear towards the end of section 3. Besides Composition Improvisation Number 1, 2, and 3, which is attributed to Mitchell as the solo composer, the library owns a handful of albums by the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which are definitely more high-tempo, jazz-oriented affairs, with a bit of surrealist Africana thrown in to really subvert your expectation. So, Crystal, do you have some rack?
Of course, Brian. What do you expect from me? I've been furiously cross-stitching my Best of 2008 list. One of my favorite CDs is showing up on a lot of critics' lists, and for good reason. Santa Gold is the genre-blurring debut release by Santi White. Her resume includes work as a major label A&R scout, frontwoman for Philly pop-punk band Stift, and songwriter for the likes of Ashley Simpson and Lily Allen. But forget all that. She's aiming to rise to the top, reborn as Santa Gold, proclaiming, "I was chosen."
Tell me no, I say yes, I was chosen, and I will deliver the
Although Santal Gold might be slightly reminiscent of her friend M.I.A., in fact, M.I.A. producer Switch created the beats for the clip you just heard, the rest of the album goes way beyond the blunt force beats and riotous vocals. While journeying through the musical towns of new wave, rock, reggae, electronic, and dance, Santal Gold remains proudly pop, bringing to mind Annie Lennox, Pretenders, or even the Go-Go's. I don't usually mention album cover art, but if you haven't seen it, Santal Gold's is worth addressing. The image is a black and white photo of Santy as she vomits golden glitter. She may not have the Midas touch, but Santal Gold has the gift for creating music with staying power.
I can't believe you read that.
Hello, this is Amanda and Julie, and we've got two books that we think you should check out. Julie's going to start with the book Them by Nathan McCall.
Thanks, Amanda. This book is about the effects of gentrification on inner-city neighborhoods from the perspective of the people who have lived there most of their lives. The book's protagonist, Barlow Reed, works in a print shop and rents a house with his nephew in the Fourth Ward of Atlanta, Martin Luther King's old neighborhood. Although somewhat run down, this is a strong African-American community near downtown. It's a place where no one is wealthy, but everyone has a stake in the neighborhood, and most people know each other. There's a little store where old men hang out and shoot the breeze, an after-hours joint where people shoot pool, gamble, and drink, and of course churches and active civic organizations. When realtors with white clients start suddenly showing up on a regular basis, people get nervous, and when a white couple buys the house next door, Barlow really feels the encroachment. The couple, Sean and Sandy, made the decision to buy in the neighborhood because it's close to downtown where Sean works, and Sandy is hopeful about the opportunity to confront the racial barriers that have always troubled her. However, the neighbors haven't been at all welcoming. After rebuffing many of her friendly attempts to connect, Barlow reluctantly begins to have conversations with her while both are doing yard work. I'm sorry that my husband and I are so misunderstood around here, and I'm sorry that people can't seem to let go of the past. She sat up on her knees. Is there nothing else to think about? Her tone was almost pleading now. I mean, will we ever be able to move on? Barlow started digging again. Maybe not in the way you think. She stared at him. What? He shrugged. Too much water. Water? Too much water under the bridge. A pained expression spread across Sandy's face. You, what a morbid view, he shrugged. It is what it is. At that moment, she felt in herself the potential to actually hate Barlow, right along with the rest of them. It startled her to know she could feel that way. These people were starting to wear on her. How could they reject her? Many times she defended them, their peculiar habits and behaviors, in dinner party debates, and now they were rejecting her. It seemed unfair. You know what bothers me most? No, Sandy, what bothers you most? That was the first time she'd heard him call her name. In the time she had known him, he had avoided addressing her directly. She had wondered if he even remembered her name. What bothers me, she said, her anguish pitch rising again, is I'm sick of people making these sweeping judgments. I'm telling you, it's crazy. It's just crazy, and I don't understand. Barlow sat up on his knees and took off his gardening gloves. These people been out here toiling most of their lives. You came in on a whim, so what don't you understand? As you can tell from this conversation, McCall is able to incorporate the everyday ironies of the situation, such as white visitors to the Martin Luther King Center being afraid to get out of their cars, and clueless new arrivals happily drinking lattes at the cafe, which soon replaced the old community store. As the months pass, some longtime residents sell out as their property taxes skyrocket, and tense neighborhood meetings and personal confrontations take place as both groups try to deal with the inherent culture clash. I found the book to be a perceptive look at the way the privileged class often feels entitled to take whatever it wants without understanding its true value or history. And of course, Them applies to the people on both sides of the divide. This is a thought-provoking novel. Amanda, What's your latest recommendation?
Well, I found L.A. Banks when I stumbled across her Vampire Huntress series here at the library. I've enjoyed these books with their interesting blend of religion and pop culture, not to mention the combination of evil hell-dwelling vampires and righteous band of demon hunters that double as a rock band. So needless to say, I was excited when I found out about a new series she'd written, this time focusing on werewolves instead of vampires. Bad Blood is the first book in her Crimson Moon series. Where Banks previously combined the paranormal with the religious, here she uses a military setting for her own take on shapeshifters. Sasha Trudeau is an elite soldier and member of the Marine Corps Paranormal Containment Unit. Each member of her four-man squad has been infected in some manner, contracting a virus that imbues them with special powers. Not only does this make them stronger, but it also brings them closer together. Here's a sample. Okay, so tell me why a Marine Corps bred, Delta One, highly trained, super intelligent chick from the PCU needs all her pack members to put together her IKEA bookshelf on a Saturday night, Woods said as he came out of the kitchen, toting two beers in one hand, while chomping on a slice of pepperoni and sausage pizza with the other. Because I want this done before we have to move out again. I hate leaving things unfinished, Sasha argued. You've got OCD, Trudeau, Woods said. You know that, right? It's a sickness. This everything in its place before you deploy superstition thing you've got going on. Well, if you guys can't handle the directions, that's all you had to say. Sasha jumped up to her feet and headed to the kitchen to get herself a slice of pizza. You hear a challenge, Fish? Woods beamed at Fisher and handed off one of the beers to him. The PCU not only hears, but accepts the challenge, Fisher said, laughing as he saluted the lieutenant and then howled, causing Woods to join in. Will Sasha's team survive their next mission without her? Why was she sent to North Korea on her own? And who is this dark, mysterious Max Hunter who has been lurking around? All these answers and more can be found between the pages of Banks' book. Now, if paranormal romance isn't your thing, Banks also writes under the pseudonyms Leslie Estale, Leslie Banks, and Leslie Estale Banks. These books are more in the romance or chick lit genre. Whatever genre you choose, though, you can't go wrong by reading something from L.A. Banks or one of her pseudonymous counterparts.
I can't believe you watched that.
Hi, this is Bill Chamberlain from the Popular Materials Department. The filmmaker George A. Romero is quoted as saying, "I don't answer any questions or preach. My personality and my opinions come through in the satire of the films, but I think of them as a snapshot of the time. I have this device or conceit where something happens in the world and I can say, 'Ooh, I'll talk about that,' and I can throw some zombies in it and get it made. You know, it's a ticket to ride." Well, the ride I want to recommend to you is George A. Romero's latest movie, Diary of the Dead, which is his fifth zombie film. He made his first zombie film back in 1968 with Night of the Living Dead, the now famous cult movie that put him on the cinematic landscape. For the past 40 years since George Romero has been making movies, his zombie films have dealt with such diverse subjects as racism, consumerism, the military-industrial complex, and the gap between wealthy and the poor. Romero's latest film, Diary of the Dead, is no exception because he deals with the aftermath of 9/11, the Iraq invasion, Hurricane Katrina. He also looks at the new media explosion and how hard it is to get the real story. Romero also cast a satirical eye towards his own genre, the horror film. George Romero said it best, "This one comes from the heart. It's not a sequel or a remake. It's a whole new beginning for the dead." Diary of the Dead centers on a group of film students who are making a grade Z horror movie on video. In the midst of making their movie, the students hear radio reports of the dead awakening. The group then climbs aboard their Winnebago and thus begins a road trip into the unknown. The movie then becomes a filmmaker's obsession, videotaping a group of people within a 48-hour time frame. Diary of the Dead is filmed with the subjective camera movement, much like the Blair Witch Project and Cloverfield. That's the only similarity that those two films have. Blair Witch Project and Cloverfield went for the cheap scare. Diary of the Dead went for the scare and also the satire on the new media explosion. So, if you like your horror films with social satire and flesh-eating zombies, Diary of the Dead is for you. Clint, what are you watching?
I've been watching something a little bit different than Diary of the Dead. When Charles Burnett started shooting The Killer of Sheep in the early 70s, the face of African-American cinema was the glorified mugs of the pimps and pushers in such films as Superfly and The Mac. Burnett, wishing to seize such images from this romanticized pap, set out to show the way people really lived in his neighborhood of Watts. That's not to say that crime was not a part of the neighborhood. It also didn't define it either. This was a world of work and family and the toll that it takes on one trying to deal with the struggle. The title Killer of Sheep refers to the lead character Stan, a worker in a slaughterhouse of that woolly animal. It is a thankless job with a meager wage, but Stan seems to take it in stride. It is in Stan's home life that his emotional paralysis comes to the forefront. His wife gets the brunt of this burden as her affections are consistently rebuked in a way that seems more frightened than unloving. We know that Stan loves his wife, it's just that he has lost how to relate to her. What makes Killer of Sheep different from your standard kitchen sink drama is its form. Stan's day-to-day occurrences are brought to us in an elliptical fashion that is more consistent with European cinema. Seemingly random scenes of such events as Stan's wife preening herself in a reflection from a pot top as she cooks, or Stan and a friend scraping enough money together to purchase a car engine that soon comes to a tragic yet humorous end, are juxtaposed with the poetic punctuation of Stan's travails at the slaughterhouse or the local kids playing in the neighborhood with a freedom and reckless abandon that Stan's life does not afford him. It is in this form and lack of Hollywood's three-act structure that gives Killer of Sheep its freshness 30 years after it was finished. The writer Michael Tolkien had a great thought on Killer of Sheep's form and how it works with Burnett's worldview. He wrote, "It's one of the most interesting narrative films ever, since it suggests that poverty deprives people of a third act. Only shown sporadically because of music right issues, Milestone Films finally cut its way through the legal red tape and released Killer of Sheep to the theaters in 2007. You can check it out from the library as a part of the Charles Burnett Collection, a two-disc DVD set that consists of Killer of Sheep, two versions of his second film, My Brother's Wedding, and four short films that make this collection the perfect primer for Burnett's deeply humanist cinema." And now Bill Chamberlain is back to tell us about what movie events we have going on at the library this month.
Join your Movies at Main host Thursday, February 12th for a date movie with a social conscience as we present the 2006 romantic comedy Something New, starring Love and Basketball's Santa Lantham and Simon Baker from the TV show The Mentalist. That's Thursday, February 12th, 5:45 p.m. at the Main Library, downtown Nashville.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic Podcast. For more information, please visit library.nashville.org.
That's on the interweb.